Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Oh, dear, Rebecca sighed and passed a piece of paper to her husband, Brad.
What's the matter?
He looked at the note.
Oh, so why does Mark's teacher want him to get tested? Don't they do enough testing at school?
It's not that kind of test, honey. Rebecca began busying herself reshelving the dinner dishes, but her hands were shaking. This kind of testing is because Mrs. Canfield feels Mark is having some problems doing his schoolwork. She paused and then found to her surprise that her eyes were tearing up.
And maybe we can find out exactly what's wrong and what can be done to help him.
Brad walked over and gave her a hug.
It's going to be okay, honey. I'm sure these testing people know just how to figure things out. Mark will be fine, you'll see. I hope so, Rebecca sniffled. But what do we tell him about all this?
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about evaluation and testing for our children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is an expert in this field. Dr. Susan Van Oost is Director of Educational and Neuropsychological Assessments and Solutions in Bethesda, Maryland. She has been in private practice since 1989, specializing in psychological and neuropsychological and personality assessment of children, adolescents, and adults. She has two sons, 27 and 17. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Van Oost.
Well, thank you very much.
What is the first thing you tell parents when they arrive in your office with a child who needs to be assessed and tested?
When someone calls the office, we initially schedule a telephone appointment to understand the nature of the problem. It would be impossible to design an appropriate evaluation without having an extensive conversation with the parent first about the child's background and whatever history there might be to the current problem to get their perspective on what they think might be going on. So it's a very extended and careful interview of the parent to understand what their concerns are, what they think the teacher's concerns are, and so on. So by the time someone walks into the office, the parent knows me, knows something about me personally, knows exactly what we're going to be doing, and I've talked to them about what to tell their child.
So they arrive and they're not quite as frantic as they are when they're first on the phone.
Hopefully not at all.
What's the most common misconception that parents have about all this?
I think they worry that the evaluation is going to be harmful to the child, that the child is going to feel put down or discouraged or embarrassed by the process of assessment, when in fact, most of the children who come to our office wind up enjoying it. They might not feel that way quite in the initial minutes of the first session, but very quickly it becomes a fairly relaxed procedure. What I ask the parents to tell the child and what I tell the child myself is that we are here to identify strengths and weaknesses. We all have them, me included. Mm-hmm. I ask them to talk about their parents' strengths and weaknesses, and the kids are often experts about that.
Frightening, isn't
right,
it?
Right, exactly. And so we all have strengths and weaknesses. Everybody on the planet does. And the question is, what might yours be? What sorts of things come more easily? That would be a strength. What kinds of things come more slowly, that would be a weakness. Not necessarily at all a disability, but just what comes more easily, what comes more slowly. If we can understand that about a child, we can make life easier for them. So my point to the child is, you got to be in school for God knows how many more years, and why not make it as easy as possible? That's the purpose of the evaluation, is to understand enough about what comes more easily or more slowly for you so that we can provide whatever support you might need.
When my oldest son, who's now 35, was in nursery school, the teacher at the first parent-teacher conference told my husband and me, you need to let your son know when you make mistakes or when you're having a problem.
Right.
Your son thinks you never do. Uh-huh. If you burn the toast or if you break a glass, right. make sure to call attention to it. Say it really loud if he's not
exactly.
in the room or whatever.
Yeah, right.
She said, this child needs to know that parents are not infallible, that parents do goof up and mm-hmm. parents do have problems.
Exactly. That's the elementary school child, needless to say, around 13 or 14.
They get it.
A lot of that innocence is lost.
Do you ever have elementary age kids who will tell you their strengths and their weaknesses and forget about the school part? In other words, they'll say, well, I really can't throw a baseball, you know, and you have to sort of get around to the fact of, well, how are things in school?
Well, you know, baseball is part of school, and school is a social environment. I'm interested in everything that the kid does, not just what would necessarily be addressed by tests. So I'm interested in hearing from the parent whether they're involved in sports teams, whether they're involved with community organizations, who their friends are. Are they in the neighborhood or outside of the neighborhood? We want a picture of the total person, of which test results are a part.
In our story at the opening of this show, we talked about a child having been recommended for assessment by a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of concerns would lead teachers to make that kind of suggestion?
The answer to that question depends on where the child is in his or her educational career. In early elementary school, teachers will become concerned about whether a child can sit still long enough to complete quote-unquote seat work, whether they'll become concerned about the rate at which the child is acquiring the early basic skills that are typical of early elementary, like learning to read words or learning to count or learning to execute letters with paper and pencil. And if any of those skills appear to be developing more slowly than is typical for that class, the teacher will pick up on that, as well as, you know, the child's general ability to comply with instructions and sit still when they have to and get along with their peers. Any of those issues could arise in elementary school. Later in elementary and middle school, the issues tend to be a little different. If the child has progressed well up to that point, certainly there are children who aren't identified, who have had a history of difficulty but are not identified to that point. But if a child has progressed well up to, say, grade 6, then the issues can be more those of organization and being able to manage multiple tasks in different courses simultaneously and keeping track of the demands of different teachers. So the issues tend to fall more in the area of what we call executive function, the ability to plan and organize and strategize an approach to learning, an approach to management of time and materials. In high school, those same issues continue but become more acute, so that the need for the student to be an independent learner increases. And as the level of abstraction and the complexity of the material increases along with the organizational demands, students can sometimes find themselves falling behind. Mm-hmm. So again, I think it varies. I think also emotional issues, while certainly possible in early elementary, come more to the fore in middle and high school. Mm-hmm.
Got very emotional kids in middle and high school.
Right, that's for sure.
In a different way.
Yeah.
What does the process involve when the child comes in? First, you say hello to the parents, and you have a little talk, I guess, mm-hmm. and then you say, the child, come with me, and you take the child into a separate room, right?
Yeah.
And then what happens?
Well, actually, I'm pretty flexible about that. Certainly, it depends on the situation. I think that the vast majority of children are comfortable coming with me into the office. And my first question to them once the door closes is, do you know why you're here? I mean, we get that right out on the table. And I get an opportunity to say what I've already told the parent to say, which is, everybody has strengths and weaknesses. I'll be happy to tell you about mine. And that's what we're here for, is to identify what comes more quickly, what comes more slowly, to make your life easier. And I can't do it without you. I need your help. So, and I'm absolutely serious about that. I need your help. I need your cooperation. If you need breaks, let me know. I'll give you a break. It's not school in the sense that I'm going to insist that you sit here for X amount of time. We need to get our work done, but I'm interested in having you have as good a time as you can. Sometimes we'll jog around our waiting room. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll go for a walk outside. Sometimes we'll play Legos or draw, or if I have access to the internet that day, we might play a game on the internet. It depends. But the idea is for the kid to have a reasonably good time and to feel reasonably relaxed. And I think we managed in 99% of the cases.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on evaluation and testing of children.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, the popular Photos Guide by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Susan Van Oost about evaluation and testing of children.
The purpose of testing, the purpose of administering tests, is to provide an objective view of what this person's function is like in various areas. By objective, I mean that we are comparing this child's performance on these tests to what we know is typical of children that age. And a lot of research and a lot of study has gone into developing what we call norms. That is, what we know is typical, what's average, what's above average, what's below average, let's say, with respect to reading or math or writing or problem solving or sustained attention or fine motor skills or anxiety or worry, worry or discouragement. We know what typical function is. At various ages, that's the whole point of administering tests, is to compare this child's individual function to what we know is typical or atypical for a child that age. So what I'm doing in there is I'm administering tests that are very carefully developed so that we can accurately confirm or disconfirm the impressions that people have had in other settings. The teacher, in interacting with the child, has developed an impression that maybe this is the issue. Maybe it's attention. The mother may feel it's anxiety. And in my administering of the tests, in a standardized, objective way, I'm providing some objective data as to what the issue might be.
Now, with something like anxiety, that's not measured, I assume, on a paper and pencil test. It's measured as you are observing the child.
There are paper and pencil tests, plenty of them, for the measurement of anxiety in various types, performance anxiety, social anxiety, generalized anxiety. There's a lot of different ways to be worried.
That's very comforting.
As we know as adults.
That's right. I mean, basically, that's what anxiety is. It's worry. Mm-hmm. And so some people have specific worries, some people have very generalized worries, but nevertheless, there's plenty of paper and pencil tests designed to assess that. Some children are more comfortable filling out yes-no questionnaires on the subject of worry than they are discussing it with me face-to-face, and some kids are more forthcoming in interview, so you do both.
So basically the process is a combination of sort of an interview and paper
Absolutely.
And pencil
yes,
activities.
Yes. This kind of process really does require somebody who has been doing it for a long time because it's not...
You mean the tester, not the kid.
The tester.
Okay. Right. Just
yes.
checking.
Kids only have to do it right. Exactly. But it really does require a professional who has had a number of years of experience with not only administering the test but integrating this information across different functional areas so that the way the kid reads has some relationship to the way they do math, has some relationship to the way they filled out the worry questionnaire. It's the integration of those bits and pieces of information. It's also the willingness of the professional to not just sit with a test score, not just be satisfied with a test score, but to understand how the child achieved that score.
Are there different kinds of procedures then for different things you're looking for?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes. Mm. I think that in recent years, given the burgeoning body of research with respect to reading, that we've become quite good at assessing reading skills and identifying the nature of the problem and the type of intervention. That's an area that testers, if you will, or evaluators can be quite specific about these days. We can identify the accuracy of reading word recognition, the speed of reading word recognition. If reading word recognition is accurate but slow or inaccurate, I mean, either way, we can identify the neuropsychological, the auditory and memory functions that might be responsible for that problem, be it either a problem with accuracy or speed or both. So in terms of reading comprehension, we can assess reading comprehension in terms of a multiple choice format and in terms of question and answer format. People perform very differently depending on the kind of test you give. So with respect to reading, I think it's pretty sophisticated at this point. Less so with respect to math and written expression. But certainly for a written expression test, you'd want to have some assessment of the child's ability not only to write single sentences, but also an assessment of the speed at which they're able to call up words associated with a particular topic and the ability to write paragraphs. At least from the third grade on, those are probably essential parts of a reading evaluation. Math evaluations are still primarily paper and pencil calculation and problem solving, but we can also look at the speed at which these performances can be executed. So we can look at the speed at which a child is able to understand or read a sentence, the speed at which a child is able to recall math facts, or the speed at which a child can execute even very simple sentences. So increasingly, test procedures are addressing not just accuracy, but the fluency. Another word for fluency is the efficiency or speed of the performance. With respect to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is, you know, there's two different types there. We're talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, comma, inattentive type, comma, combined type, or comma, impulsive type. There's three different forms of ADHD. So you can, it's confusing because you can have this ADHD nomenclature and just be inattentive, spacey. It says attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. People get confused by that because of the word hyperactivity. But in fact, it can be just a reference to somebody who's spacey. That evaluation should occur in the context of a broader assessment. It often does not. But the recommendation really in the field is that ADHD not be evaluated simply as a single issue, but that there be some documentation of how it affects the rest of life. How does it affect the way you read? How does it affect the way you do math? I mean, ADHD kids are famous for misreading words because they're not looking at them very closely, or for misreading operational signs so they wind up subtracting when they should add, or not proofing their written work. I mean, there's lots of ways that that problem can affect academic performance. And so it's important not only to identify the presence or absence of that issue, but also how it affects the rest of life. Peer relationships, for example. Impulsive kids are famous for sort of charging through their peer relationships and irritating people. So, but ADHD does have a specific set of diagnostic procedures associated with it. One would be the collection of standardized rating scale data from parents and teachers so that there's some documentation that this is an issue that exists across settings, not just at home or at school, but across settings pervasively. And just as there are researched instruments for the assessment of reading and math and writing, there are also researched instruments for the assessment of parental ratings and teacher ratings. A teacher's rating execution of a rating scale is compared to what we know is typical of teachers of six-year-olds. And a parent's execution of a rating scale is compared to what we know is typical for parents of six-year-olds. So, and that can be done all the way through the lifespan. So it's very important to have that. Impressionistic data is not the way to go with ADHD. We want to use what's called standardized rating scales, where there are these comparisons to normative populations so that we know that what this person is reporting is typical or atypical relative to what we know is typical for parents or teachers of a particular age child.
And this is gotten by asking the parents questions. You know, does Johnny usually, you know, run away from the dinner table immediately?
Well, actually, it's a combination of things. We give teachers several different questionnaires to fill out on each child that we evaluate. So we're asking them about emotional function, academic function, and organizational function. So the teachers fill that out. It's paper and pencil. They submit it to us, and we run it through the computer. Same thing for parents. So the parents and teachers are each filling out similar kinds of questionnaires, and then the child fills out a questionnaire, which is similar to what the parents and teachers have reported. We get to compare those three sources of data. Now, that is testing, even though there is no face-to-face administration. It's still a standardized questionnaire backed up by lots of research into what we know is typical for children of a certain age.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on evaluation and testing of children.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Susan Van Oost about evaluation and testing of children. Mm-hmm. What kinds of results should parents anticipate, and what kind of follow-up happens after the assessment?
That's probably the most important part of the evaluation. What is the point of doing all of this
right.
if you don't come out with some answers? I mean, and clearly expressed answers that you can understand. Anybody who has their child evaluated has a right to a diagnosis. And several diagnoses, if that's necessary. Is it ADHD? Is it some form of attention? Is there a learning disability? If so, what kind? Is there an emotional problem? If so, what kind? And then, having made those diagnoses and given the reasons for the diagnoses, the evaluator has a responsibility to identify how these issues are affecting life, this child's life. If it's attention, how does that play out in the child's execution of schoolwork or peer relationships? If it's an emotional issue, how does that play out in terms of schoolwork or peer relationships? If it's a reading problem, what kind of reading problem is it? At what level? Is it a problem with learning phonics? Is it a problem with word recognition? Is it a problem with speed? We don't know. And there's a different kind of intervention for each one of those. So first you get the diagnosis, then you get the what's called the functional limitations, that is, the impact of this problem on behavior, and then recommendations. What do you do about it? And the individual has a right to expect that to be expressed in comprehensible language.
Now, how do parents, when they think that there might be something wrong at the beginning of this whole process, select an appropriate evaluative and testing facility?
It really is not easy. There aren't, quite frankly, that many evaluators who do what I just said: diagnosis, functional limitations, and clearly expressed recommendations.
Okay, so if I'm a parent and I'm in Missouri or Massachusetts or someplace and I'm trying to find an evaluation and testing facility, where do I go to start?
I would go to a university center. I would go someplace where they're doing research in education or special education, or if the parent thinks it might be a psychological issue, then psychological function. But I would be inclined to go to a university center. And I would be inclined to request that the testing be done by someone with several years' experience, not by a student, but someone who has several years, multiple years' experience in the interpretation of tests. In my facility, it is possible for someone to call up and ask for a sample report. Now, of course, this is completely anonymous. There's no reference to any specific person. But they get to see what our recommendations look like, what our diagnostic formulations look like, and to get a sense of whether it communicates to them. Do they understand?
That's really remarkable to me. I never knew you could do something like that.
Well, I think it's important, actually very important.
Is there a title of somebody that people should use when they want to get something? Sometimes, you know, when we're saying something, we have to use the right words. What should we be asking for? We want somebody who is called, is there a title or is there a job description or something?
There's a number of titles.
Okay.
Educational diagnostician, neuropsychologist, psychologist, most likely at the PhD level.
Okay.
Now, I realize that there are parts of the country where that might not be possible, in which case you go for a master's level person. Probably what more critically important than the degree is this individual's experience with doing this kind of assessment. I think it's desirable to have somebody who's not committed to a particular test or test battery, but who is thinking in terms of function.
How would a parent know
that?
Well,
I think you have to ask, how do you go about assessing reading?
Okay, and if they say then you say, well, do you ever use anything else?
Exactly.
Okay.
Dr. Van Oost, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've been discussing?
There's an enormous amount of information on the web. One of my favorite sites is schwablearning.org, S-C-H-W-A-B, learning, all one word, schwablearning.org. Charles Schwab, as you may or may not know, is the head of a major investment company in New York. He discovered that he was dyslexic when he had his own son evaluated. and from that experience has funded the development of the site, which is extraordinarily informative. It is possible to download information on practically any aspect of learning disability and diagnosis or intervention. And it's very readable. There are places that you can contact them for further information. Almost everything on there is downloadable, printable, very useful site. Another one that I would suggest, which is probably a little less known, is Special Connections, www.specialconnections. I think it's .edu, which is really a site for teachers, but it lists all of the research-based interventions that teachers are urged to use in the teaching of reading, math, and writing. So for a parent who may not have as many resources in their community, it's a place to start, as is the Schwab Learning site, in terms of identifying ways of helping their own children. The books that I would recommend, probably the two that I use the most, for learning disability, it's The Misunderstood Child, second edition, by Dr. Larry Silver. And Dr. Silver also has a second edition of a book on ADHD. It's called Dr. Larry Silver's Advice to Parents on ADHD. And Dr. Russell Barkley has a second edition of his book titled Taking Charge of ADHD. And those are very standard and very useful texts for parents.
Well, you have been a wonderful resource for all of us about evaluation and testing. So, Dr. Susan Van Oost, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is a copy of The Little Book, a collection of stories, articles, and parenting tips and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who love and care for children and teens with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please mention show number 305. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we air all over the world, it's fun to know where you are tuning in. Anything you can spell, by the way, would be very helpful. Sometimes the message machines are not as clear as we'd like them to be. Our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available in all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. At the site, you can even hear a show at any time. Just scroll down to the topic or guest of your choice and click onto the words Listen to Podcast below. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.